Chiland Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the Friday episode of the Calcioland podcast. So the football gods have been good to us. We have England and Italy in the Euro final. So I know we haven't covered the Euro too much, but Alex and I will chat a little bit about it at the top. Transfer gods were also good to us. Giroud to Milan is all but official. So we'll kind of talk a little bit about Giroud's legacy at Chelsea. I'll put Alex on the spot with an over-under for goals of Giroud at Milan. Yesterday, Mourinho was introduced as Roma's manager. So we definitely have to talk about that. This is transfer season, so we'll cover our hot transfer topics. We have a part of the show for our patrons. And at the end, you'll hear the beginning of an awesome chat I had with Francesco, one of my favorite Twitter accounts. On this version of the show, you'll hear us talk about Chiellini, Bonucci, kind of the current Italian defenders. And our patrons are going to hear the full episode where Francesco and I also drafted our favorite Serie A defenders from the past 40 years. But we have to start with the Euro. I know we haven't talked about it too much, but the episode we are recording Friday, the final is on Sunday. So Alex, who is actually knows some of the players on kind of our, you know, the guy that gives us the perspective, maybe a little bit outside the Serie A bubble. So I want to ask you a couple of things, Alex. First off, there is this theory that, yeah, it's great that England has this at home and they're playing at Wembley and they're going to have, it's going to be pretty much almost all England fans. But even Conte mentioned it today, that could be a double-edged sword with all the pressure of it's coming home. So Alex, let's start here. You know some of these players and you're pretty familiar with England as a team as a whole. Do you buy this whole thing that, yes, being at home could be an advantage, but also the pressure and all might also be a disadvantage?
Oh, 1,000%. Listen, I already have seen Chiellini's statement. He said, well, of course they're in the final. 6 out of the 7 games they've played have been at home. I get that. And I'm not even saying that I wouldn't be making that type of remark if, say, I was totally supporting the Azzurri or just really was anti-England. So I totally hear gripes like, hey, every game for the most part has been at home for England. But at the same time, are you kidding me? I think the pressure on them on Sunday is going to be huge. And I do think it's a double-edged sword, of course. It's support as well, but it is pressure. So it really just comes down to each player's individual mentality. And they obviously already had such a big celebration. And when I say they, I don't really actually even mean the players. Obviously, they had a nice moment on the pitch singing Sweet Caroline with the fans. But I would say the fans more than took it to the next level. And maybe to other countries, England celebrated like they had already won it. But I think this group of players, actually, I know this group of players is supremely focused. So hopefully for them, the crowd and just all the noise will just be support and not pressure. But David, it's absolutely pressure as well. It has to be. I mean, they can't control when their fans or newspapers act like they've already won it. So if others who support you are acting like you've already won it, that is factually pressure. So it'll be very interesting, David, because what I would say is it's a really impressive group of youngsters for England in terms of their mentality. But this is going to be as pressurized as possible. So you do wonder, oh, are they going to miss a little bit of senior leadership? I know they have it with some players like a Harry Kane, and whether Jordan Henderson starts or doesn't start, he's there. And I know they have some faces, but it's a pretty young team. So how will they fare? We'll obviously just have to wait and see. But yeah, I wouldn't look at this even objectively. I know I am going for England, and that's just more because of the Chelsea factor. Yeah, Jorginho and Emerson, of course, are for Chelsea, but I think we all know how big of a fan I am of Mason Mount and others that are part of England. So I am going for England, but even objectively, David, I really think that the pressure, you could almost split down the middle, and you don't know if the home crowd is going to be just total support for them, or is it going to be total unsurmountable pressure? So yeah, I definitely think it's good on you to ask it, because I don't think it's just so black and white. Like, oh, they're going to have all the fans pretty much. Oh, they're a shoo-in to win. Italy could honestly view it as, oh, this is going to be great to shut up all these fans. Oh, this is great. And oh, they're already acting like England already won it. Oh, this is great. So you might not always want that if you're England, to have your opponent have extra motivation. They probably have plenty of motivation already, Italy, just wanting to win the damn thing. But to also then kind of have that chip on their shoulder to shut up all those fans. Yeah, maybe some England players wouldn't even want that extra motivation for Italy. So yeah, that's my take on that, the whole fan aspect. But David, let's now really turn it to the Azzurri here. Are you surprised they made the final? If you just kind of think about how you were feeling before the tournament started and everything, are you surprised that Italy is in the final?
So I'll say this. I am absolutely thrilled that they made it to the final. And I'll say it this way, because, you know, I have to say the Euro, I was very, very cynical about football between the Super League and transfers and all that. I have to say this Euro has kind of really regenerated my passion in football. So I am thrilled that Italy made it to the final and that I get to watch every game of the tournament. Italy went as far as they could. I've had a great time going to the North End. Shout out to Café dello Sport, watching the games there. So I'm extremely grateful and thrilled that they got this far. As far as being surprised, I can't say that I really am. And usually I'm not that confident with Italy. But going into the tournament, you know, this was one time that they were kind of one of the favorites going in. And they had a great qualifying round. We wondered, though, what would happen when Italy would face a top team, which, you know, fair or unfair, Mancini really had it when Italy was undefeated. So they were great in the group stage. I think they were as good as any team in the group stage. Then we had the game against Austria, which, you know, reason for concern. I thought Austria played really well. And, you know, there were parallels. I thought Austria played a little bit like the way Gasperini used to play against Sarri's Napoli and make their life really miserable. So I was a little concerned there. I thought the game against Belgium was a brilliant performance. And I thought the game against Spain, I have to give a lot of credit to Luis Enrique. I thought his game plan was like perfect. Took away the frame of reference up front, not starting Morata. Then Morata comes in, ties the game. And then thank God Morata also missed the penalty. Later, I thought that game was really 50-50. Spain probably deserved a little bit more, but I felt great about Italy going to PKs with Donnarumma, because I think he's just unbelievable. I know for Milan fans, it's hard to watch Donnarumma play this well, but, you know, maybe those who really want to see England lose can put that, you know, kind of on pause on Sunday. So I have to say, I'm not that surprised that they made it. I think they earned it. I think they've been as good a team in this Euro. I think once France was eliminated, I was like, we have a really good chance of, you know, making the final. So, yeah, I'm very curious to see what happens Sunday. It's going to be a great game. Before we move on to Giroud, Alex, let me ask you. In, you know, in England circle, let's say outside of the Serie A bubble, how would you say this Italy team is viewed? Do you think England fans are genuinely concerned about Italy on Sunday, or do you think they feel like they already have it in the bag?
No, I think anybody sensible views Italy as definitely a tall task. Yeah, it's really important to separate these over-the-top fans who are saying it's coming home. And by the way, most people, I just want to say this in case there are just total Azzurri fans listening who don't even follow anything English. The saying it's coming home is 85% banter. And I know I'm not even from England, but I can tell you, after speaking to loads of people about that saying, it is really heavy on the banter. Yeah, now they might believe it is actually coming home. But the whole saying and singing it loud and everything, it's almost cynical. It's almost because they have failed so much, and it's heavy, heavy banter. So it's important to try and separate the people who are just singing it and really being over the top with it from people actually giving maybe a game analysis, which I am now about to echo. I think English fans and non-English fans just in viewing the Atsuri in this game, tall task, and probably if you had to pick the best team in the tournament, they have been. Because until Spain kind of took them out of their element, Italy were just absolutely dominant. So, yeah, I think any English fan being objective or just anybody who's objective looking at Italy here view them as absolutely deserving to be in the final. I think it's probably been a unanimous thought that Italy have been the best well-drilled team, the team with the best chemistry, the team that probably looks like they're a club team, meaning they're just so on the same page with each other. That's really hard to get in international football. A lot of teams have to play tournament football, which is, by the way, what I think England have done. A lot of England fans have moaned about maybe the play style. They pass it, ironically, right? This is the gripe against Jorginho. But a lot of England fans have complained that England are passing it from side to side and they're not taking advantage as much of maybe their really flashy superstar attackers. But England, and credit to Southgate, he has played tournament football. Don't beat yourselves and then eventually find the avenues to score the goals when you need to. But Italy, for the most part, have played really a fluid brand of football, which is really hard to get in international football. So, yeah, I think many have viewed them as insanely deserving to be in the final, and we'll see how Sunday goes. But if you were just to tell me that you could see the future and Italy won, I would say, well, they deserved it. They deserved it. So, yeah, I don't think I'm that much different from most. I think most, even hardcore England fans, if you can catch them in an objective moment, a sober moment, yeah, I think they would say Italy is absolutely going to be no pushover. And I don't think I'm putting words in their mouth. Yeah.
Yeah. But look at it this way. I think, and I knock on wood, if England wins on Sunday, Italy would probably be as good an opponent to do so. I mean, I guess World Cup winning France would have been, but based on how Italy played, and look, and going into the tournament, they were considered amongst the favorites. I really like what you said about Italy kind of being like playing like a great club team. Couldn't agree more. I actually think this Italy, if they were a Serie A club team, they'd be a really, really a great one. Let's shift gears to Giroud, as I mentioned. It's all but official. He's going to Milan. Kudos to Chelsea. I always say they operate well on the transfer market by extending his contract. They ensured he didn't go to another top Premier League team. They get some money, like $1 million plus $1 million in bonus from Milan for Giroud. I think that relationship, Milan-Chelsea, I think we're going to see more transfers, maybe even this summer in general. But let's just start with Giroud. I tweeted this. Got a lot of great responses from Chelsea fans. But how will you remember Alex Giroud at Chelsea?
I think you've seen probably a lot of this on Twitter, but cult hero, cult legend. And I think we use the word cult just because Giroud wasn't here forever and ever and ever. And he didn't even play consistently. But he still managed to make so many amazing moments with Chelsea. Obviously, he won both European trophies. He was monumental in winning the Europa League, highest scorer in the tournament. He was just incredible in that sorry season when Chelsea won the Europa. And then, yeah, I mean, his playing time wasn't as regular during this Champions League campaign, yet he still managed to be our top scorer in the Champions League, majorly because he scored 4 goals in one game. But then he still did stuff in other games. He had that amazing over-the-head kick against Atletico Madrid, which was really a big goal because obviously facing Atletico Madrid at that time in the Champions League, we were really unsure about how the rest of the season would go. Tuchel had taken over, but we were entering a gauntlet of a schedule. Atletico, yeah, they're probably not going to put 5 past you, but they're really hard to put any past in reverse. So Giroud scoring that goal was a huge belief moment. I can definitely speak for almost every Chelsea fan in saying that. And Giroud was just always kind of that guy for Chelsea. When maybe you needed that extra push, Giroud would just very conveniently come off the bench or get a rare start, and he would produce, and he was so dependable. And last season, he gets a heck of a lot of credit. We could almost thank him for even having the chance to win the Champions League this season because last season, he very much salvaged our Premier League season, one could argue. Second half of the season, he went from totally being phased out by Frank Lampard, this is the previous season, of course, in Lampard's first season, to being absolutely phenomenal for Chelsea in the second half of the season. He was so damn consistent. And that really helped us secure top four, which really, to many, was overachieving. So he had his moments in really all the competitions with us. I mean, he won the FA Cup with us. He won the Champions League. He won the Europa League. And he managed to have moments in all three of those competitions and obviously the Premier League as well. So, yeah, he's just so steady, David. He's so dependable. I once tweeted that Giroud is more dependable than condoms. And, you know, I kind of stand by that. I'm not saying that from my own personal experience, you know, just the classic Friends line. If anyone's ever seen that show, even if you think it's overrated, that's totally fine. I probably agree. But still, Ross, the character, is getting really upset about how it says in very fine print on the box that it only works 99.whatever% of the time. I mean, Giroud is just so damn dependable. He's never going to fill you with extra confidence, meaning like, you know his limitations, but in reverse, you never, ever think when he's out there, oh, there's no chance he's going to score. Like, he could be going bad, and then you give him one chance to score, and he scores. And by the way, last bit, maybe the most important bit. What a professional. This is a guy who was phased out sometimes, and the people ahead of him weren't scoring. Like, that was the really mind-blowing thing, is Lampard, and I get why he did it most often, but Lampard would phase him out sometimes and we weren't even scoring. And then some would say to defend Lampard, yeah, but he doesn't fit the system. But then you have to ask yourself, well, shouldn't the system be getting goals? And Giroud would still get phased out. He never moaned. He never whined. Sure, every once in a while, he did kind of make it clear the last couple of years that he'd love to play a little bit so he can remain with France. But nah, he just was such a professional. He always was mentoring youngsters, even if they were getting more playing time than him, like a Tammy Abraham, an incredible professional. And I think he's definitely one of those cases of we might not know how much we truly miss him until he is gone, because his impact on and off the pitch was pretty special and you can't take it for granted. Gets on with really every manager that at least has had him at Chelsea. So yeah, insanely grateful to what Giroud did at Chelsea.
Yeah, I love this move for Milan. And look, you know, I've been fairly critical because I think overall Milan has not had a good summer, but this is a very good move, as was keeping Tomori. You know, even before I heard you talking, you know, I was like, man, if Leao cannot get going with Giroud and Ibrahimovic as mentors there's really no hope for him. I'm a huge fan of Giroud. I think he's one of those players, even when he doesn't score, he makes an impact, but then he's extremely clutch. So real kudos to Milan for signing him here. So I want to ask you this. You know, I love doing over-unders, and maybe this number is a little low because it's in all competitions, but I was looking, you know, his stats recently. Maybe it's not that bad. So let's say in all competitions, keep in mind Milan has Zlatan, who is recovering from an injury now. He did miss a lot of time. If I set the over-under for Giroud in all competitions, Milan are in the Champions League, Coppa Italia, 13.5 goals next season, Alex. You taking the over or you taking the under?
Oh, man, that's a tough one. You're very good with the numbers. You know what? I'm going to say under, but I have to explain why. I know it's all comps, so it definitely could happen. It definitely could happen where he goes over and gets at least 14. But I'm going to say he gets somewhere between 10 and 13. But it's going to be really important, the majority of the goals he scores. So it'll feel like more, if that makes any sense. He'll make some memories and some moments, and he'll come up clutch. He definitely will. But to say 14 or more, which is really what this is saying, a bit steep. But you know what? The moment you start to doubt Giroud, he usually reminds you that he shouldn't be doubted. So I would not be surprised if I'm wrong. I definitely would not be. But I'm going to go under, but just by a smidge. And I'll just once again say that that doesn't mean the impact of him won't feel like more, because it probably will. Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Well, look, you know, if Leao gets going, because Giroud pushes him, all the better. All right, let's shift gear one more time. I saw you had a good time with this, too. I thought the introductory press conference for Mourinho was fantastic. So anything, I know you saw some of the tweets, Alex, before I give my thoughts, did anything stand out to you about what Mourinho had to say yesterday?
Well, him just reminding everyone once again of the fact that he didn't actually fail at United. Obviously, he was going to point that out, but based on that standard, people will say he did. And then the part about him getting robbed of a League Cup trophy, because, of course, we know that he was sacked less than a week before they got to play in the final. I mean, that is classic Mourinho. One could definitely say he's not wrong, but, David, Mourinho is brilliant, brilliant at spinning the context in his favor. He is so full of conviction when he says things that if you didn't know any better, you would buy everything he's saying. Where once again, I'm not even saying that he's factually incorrect, but he will make you feel like he was the victim in all of it, like he did nothing wrong, that he didn't see himself being sacked at Tottenham, that he doesn't get why maybe his tenure at United wasn't considered all that great. It's just funny to me because he set such a high bar for himself, David. Like, obviously, the greats do that. He set such a high bar for himself. Yet, if he's getting stick, or the narrative out there is that he is underachieving, he'll then start to reference accomplishments that I don't think he actually views as accomplishments for himself, but he's smart enough to reference them because for most, they're still accomplishments. So forever and ever, he said that finishing second in a season with United was maybe his best accomplishment ever. And obviously, that's not a trophy. Finishing second means nothing, except, yeah, you got Champions League football. But based on what we kind of know of Mourinho's standard, he would probably tell you one day that if you don't win a trophy, you failed. But if he is the one being questioned, he can spin it the other way and be like, look what I did with this squad. I got them to finish second. This was a squad that probably should have finished fourth or fifth. So he's just so intelligent, so smart. So, David, my big takeaway, even just from those few quotes, is he hasn't changed. He hasn't changed one bit. And that might even be a good thing. Like, I think he needs to change in terms of how he works with players, how he thinks about football. Like, I think he needs to change with the times on the actual football aspect. But I almost would be worried, David, if his press conference with Roma was all nice and nothing controversial, no good quotes. That would tell me, uh-oh, he knows he needs to change, but he's not even changing in the right way. He's not even acting like himself. So I enjoy that. Obviously, from a selfish point of view, I'm sure you can relate. God, it's box office theater. It really is. It's great if you do a Serie A podcast. It's just great if you consume football content in general. And yeah, I mean, I know this wasn't part of his press conference, but then also seeing players that what he phased out in preseason, maybe you can expand on that a little bit more. It doesn't seem like he's changed at all, David.
Yeah. Great stuff. I love that you pointed out the quotes on Spurs and Man United. Look, as you said, he's just a master communicator. You know, one of my least favorite thing in people are people that don't take responsibility for anything, don't ever hold themselves accountable, and it's always someone else's fault. But he really has that down as an art form of spinning things a certain way. You know, if this guy ever got into politics as a communicator, I mean, it's game over. The guy is just exceptional. Added. So a couple of things that I will add to that. Yeah, that quote on Man United Spurs was great. What he had to say, the dig he had at Inter was really pretty well played. He was asked, you know, what are you expecting here at Roma? And he goes, listen, we want to build something. We need time. We want to build something, not just win quickly and then ending. And he goes, you know, winning and then not being able to pay salaries of your players. You know, that's not what we want to do here. That was a huge dig at Inter. And look, you know, if you're an Inter fan, you could say, well, that was really a dig at ownership, but he still loves us as fans. So he is just perfect at toying that line. Also, the other thing that stood out to me is when he was asked, you know, about Conte at Inter, and he goes, don't even go there. There are managers at clubs you should never compare to. And at Roma, he goes, I wouldn't want people to compare me to Capello, the plenty have. And Capello won a Scudetto there, and I'm sure Mourinho would love that. And Lidom, who was their historic coach in the 70s and 80s, and he goes, well, I don't want to be compared to them. I shouldn't, so you shouldn't compare Conte to me. So classic Mourinho. The last thing that I'll say is that he said, look, you know, when he was asked, you know, what's going to happen in these next 3 years, and he goes, we're definitely going to have something to celebrate. I still say the thing that people might celebrate is when he actually leaves. I feel like Mourinho's like a boat. The two best days are the day that you get it. And yesterday was absolutely sensational, the roll-up of him arriving. And then the second best day as a boat owner is when you sell it and you're done with the headache. So let's see if that's what happens with Mourinho. But as you said, Alex, anyone who covers calcio should be absolutely thrilled that Mourinho's there. As you said, some players excluded from the retreat, Pedro being one of them. So, yeah, the Mourinho regime here has started for sure at Roma. And, yeah, I'm very excited for it. I think this is going to be a lot of fun. You know, there were other pressers yesterday. Pioli, Spalletti, has been great coverage on them. Allegri back, who I think is as good a communicator as well. It's just too bad that Conte isn't also there. But we're in for a lot of fun in Serie A next season. So before we get to our patrons and Francesco, there's transfers going on. So, Alex, what hot transfer topics are we going to cover today?
Yeah, well, let's stay topical and let's have the segue be as smooth as possible. David, who will be the first additions for Jose Mourinho at Roma?
Yeah, so look, Roma had an extremely bloated squad even before they excluded five players, not just Pedro, from the retreat. They have been able to move a few. So Sengisander went to Marseille. Paul Lopez was their most expensive keeper ever, is also heading to Marseille. So they're kind of, they had to move those. So it sounds like Rui Patricio is going to be the first addition for Roma. You know, they definitely need a keeper that's more reliable than what they've had recently. And then the other is likely going to be Zaka, but they're waiting for Arsenal to sign another midfielder. And that midfielder looks like it will be probably Ruben Navas for Arsenal. And when that happens, that should free up Zaka for Roma. So let's see what happens beyond that. I think Roma, what's really important is sorting out the striker position, sorting out who's going to replace Spinazzola. But it looks like the first additions are going to be a keeper and then an addition in the midfield.
Hmm. Okay. All right, David, let's move to another hot topic for sure. Do you think it's inevitable that Locatelli goes to Juve?
Inevitable might be strong, but I think it's very likely. Again, I don't put too much stock into stuff like this, but even Locatelli on Instagram, and he missed the penalty, by the way, but he posted a picture of the celebration and of Italy celebrating, and the shot was him hugging Chiellini. Maybe that was completely, you know, a coincidence, but look, even Sassuolo's sporting director Carnevali keeps saying publicly, yeah, we're going to meet with Juve about Locatelli. It sounds to me that maybe not as forcibly as Chiesa, who was really determined to stay in Italy and go to Juve. I think Locatelli at his age kind of sees it that way. Juve really could use him. That's for sure. Allegri wants him. So I don't know if inevitable, but I'd say I'd be really quite surprised if Locatelli isn't on Juve next season. But I also think he'll be the only main addition they have too.
Okay. All right, David, let's move on to this. Who is more likely to replace Hakimi at Inter? Zappacosta or Bellerin?
Sounds maybe Bellerin right now. I wouldn't exclude that they sign both, but, you know, they have options there. Darmian can play on both sides. Perisic had a good Euro and finished the season strong there. So, and he's more on the left side. So, you know, I think they're going to get one of these two. I wouldn't exclude both. It looks maybe Bellerin a little bit more now because Arsenal seem open to a loan with option to buy. I'm not a huge expert on Bellerin. I have to say, I've always liked Zappa Costa. I thought he had a good season at Genoa. I think he could fit in well for Inzaghi. It doesn't sound like it would be Lazzari, which I know a lot of Inter fans want. Sarri, you know, broke his silence. I know today he had his official press conference, but he had an interview earlier this week, and he singled out Lazzari as a player he's looking forward to playing with. And I have a feeling Lazzari is going to play more in the Callejon role, so more up front. I think he'll have a real right back, probably his age and there. So I don't think Inter fans, it's going to be Lazzari. It looks Bellerin more likely than Zappa Costa right now, but I probably would rather have Zappa Costa.
Okay. All right, David, what did you make of Tonali cutting his salary to stay at Milan?
My reaction is this. You know how, you know, in high school or college, you know, you break up with your girlfriend and you feel that every song you're hearing is about that relationship going bad and either cheering you up or remembering that relationship, and it feels like everything has to do about that. When I saw the reaction to Tonali cutting his salary to Milan and seeing it compared to Donnarumma, that's kind of what I thought. It's like, honestly, this really has nothing to do one with the other, just very loosely connected. Like, look, I respect Tonali for taking a pay cut, but look, he was on loan. He could have gone back to Brescia. Milan to buy him wanted to really lower the cost of what they paid Brescia and also lower his salary. Donnarumma, on the other hand, had an offer where PSG was doubling his current salary, and he's going to a team that can win the Champions League for the foreseeable future every year. So to me, comparing the two, and I kind of get the connection, and also Calabria signing an extension, it's like my reaction is I really hope, and I'm not saying it would be a jerk, it's like I really hope Tonali improves so much as a player that it gets to the point that PSG wants to double his wages, because it means that he's made a huge impact. I like Tonali as a player, you know, like a lot of 20-year-olds in Serie A, Kulusevski, even Kumbula, Roma struggled a little bit. I think he'll be fine. But making him like a saint for cutting his salary and comparing it to Donnarumma really feels to me like, you know, when you break up with your girlfriend in high school and you feel that everything's about that when it's really not. But look, you know, this was a fun deal aside. The fun factor in this deal was Cellino, the former Leeds owner who owns Brescia, instead of 17 million. For the remaining payment on Tonali, wanted 16.999 million because 17 in Italy brings bad luck. So this is why we love Italian football, these little details. So look, I think Tonali is going to have an important player for Milan next season, no matter what happens with Kessié as far as contract, because Kessié is going to be both in the Olympics and then the Africa Cup. So this isn't a big season for Tonali. I respect him for cutting his salary, but I really don't know what other option he had. Sure, I don't think he was – let's say Milan didn't redeem him. Do I think Tonali was going to Serie B with Brescia? No, he would have gone to another team. But I'm not sure anyone was going to offer him what he was making originally. So, you know, again, I hope it gets to – he plays so well that we can actually test if Tonali is more attached to the Milan colors. And I would also throw into that don't forget that Tonali had agreed to terms with Inter before he went to Milan. So maybe the huge love for his colors, the Milan colors there when he was with Inter, wasn't as important. I know a lot of people are going to hate this answer, but these are exactly the type of things that drive me a little bit crazy. And it really reminds me that fan is short for fanatic, and it feels like, you know, for a lot of fans it's all about defending your team at all costs, and I respect that. And because people are so defensive and so into their teams, you know, they consume a lot of content, so I respect that. But I also think sometimes you have to look at things, maybe detach yourself a little bit and try to look at it a little bit more rationally. So I know I'll get a lot of hate for this segment, but I feel pretty strongly about this answer.
Okay. All right, David. Last one here in this segment. Do you expect Napoli to be very active this summer?
I don't. And that's probably a good thing because the big theme of the press conference for Spalletti yesterday was how much Spalletti said he liked the squad and how much he thinks he can get out of it. He says, you know, we're going to defend in 4-2-3-1 and Napoli clearly has the players for that and will easily shift to 4-3-3 in the attack. And he said he really rated the squad. So, short of Napoli getting huge offers, I think for their players, I think we're going to see a lot of this back. You know, look, Insigne is pretty interesting because he has 1 year on his contract, and we've talked a lot about, you know, Milan losing players for nothing. And I keep asking myself, well, how would a De Laurentiis handled the Donnarumma and Çalhanoğlu situation? I think he would have rather sold the club than lose Donnarumma for nothing just because about De Laurentiis thing. So it's interesting what's going to happen with Insigne. I think ultimately Insigne resigns with Napoli. There's been buzz on Milan, which, you know, would be interesting, maybe on a Bosman. So let's see. But I think Koulibaly, I mean, Fabian Ruiz is going to be pretty interesting. I think, you know, I think he would have a market in the PL. I'm not sure if the clubs, the big clubs in Spain, can afford to sign him right now. But I kind of expect most of Napoli to be back. It also sounds like they won't be very active incoming. It sounds like Emerson Palmieri is a player they're really targeting. Spalletti was very coy when was asked if he had spoken to him. And, you know, they played, they were together at Roma. He basically said that they did. So I expect Emerson to come in at Napoli. I'm not sure how many other big additions they make, but I'll tell you this. You put Emerson and he stays fairly healthy. I like Gattuso, but Spalletti is clearly an upgrade. You could really talk me into picking Napoli to win the Scudetto when we do our preview. So exciting there. So before we get to Francesco, which you'll hear us talk about Chiellini, Bonucci, a little bit about it, current Italian defenders, we're going to do a part of the podcast for patrons. We have some great content on there. There's a longer version of that chat with Francesco. We'll have Napoli Outsider back next week, and we have episodes on Tuesday just for patrons, and we answer all their questions, which we're going to do now. I'm very excited to welcome our next guest. This is the third pod we've done together. Francesco was always, back in the day, one of my favorite Twitter accounts, and I'm very excited that he came back. So, you know, I immediately wanted to have him kind of be a special guest like Napoli Outsider on this show. So today, regular listeners, you'll hear us chat about Chiellini, Bonucci a little bit. Our patrons are going to hear us go more into the history of defenders in Serie A, and we'll do a draft on that. So, Francesco, always a real pleasure to chat calcio with you. Bentornato to Calcio Land.
Thanks so much. Always a pleasure to be on.
Okay, Francesco. So, as I was telling you earlier this week, I feel like the calcio gods were really good to us because we've been circling, doing a podcast on Italian Serie A central defenders for a while. And I have to say, Chiellini has really arisen to the occasion for our podcast. We're recording this on Thursday. Obviously, the game against Spain was superb, but I want to talk a little bit more about Chiellini's legacy. So let's start here, Francesco. He's going to play next season. Who knows how much more after that or if that will be it. But how do you think people are going to remember Giorgio Chiellini as a player?
No, well, let's just start by saying hopefully. I mean, I'm not doing a gufata or anything, but hopefully he's lifting a trophy on Sunday and people remember him a lot better on that end.
Yeah.
But, you know, with Chiellini, it's a weird one because if you think about it, he's kind of been, his career is like over two eras. I mean, he came out in 2004 as this, you know, humongous unorthodox left back. And part of that era of the kind of Otto and Nesta and, you know, the greatest defenders, the legendary defender generation that we had in that period. and played in that era. And even when he was even in the national team, I mean, prior to the 2006 World Cup, he didn't wind up going, but he actually made his debut and then had his move to Juventus after Fiorentina. And then he has this second, like, rebirth of his career when he moves to center back and, you know, establishes himself as one of the top defenders in Italy with Juventus and the national team. So I think, you know, obviously some things that go against him is he was a top defender in a time where Italy were not that great. So, I mean, those national team disappointments kind of are a, you know, spot on his career, although he could make a big redemption on that on Sunday. And was also part of those poor Juventus sides, but also was then part of the, you know, legendary Juventus side. So it's a tough one because I don't know if he's really viewed in the same view as like a Nesta or Cannavaro, mm-hmm. or Maldini or the upper echelons of Italian defenders. But I mean, with his performances and his trophy case, I mean, I think he has to be at least on their level, especially if he wins on Sunday.
Interesting. Yeah, I and we'll get into it in the draft, and I'm curious to see kind of where we rank him. I definitely see him in definitely a tier below the Baresi, Maldini, Nesta. I kind of see him more in the Vjerkovu, Gentile, kind of these tough man-marking defenders. I think ultimately what I'm going to remember so much about him is the one-to-one duels against Cavani, Ibra, players like that, Suarez, of course. I feel like it's kind of like an old school version of a defender. So yeah. Let's talk a little bit about that coin toss against Spain, because I thought a lot of people saw Chiellini's personality there. And look, you know, how much did that ultimately matter is hard to say. I mean, you know, you could say that, you know, a leader has to show confidence. This team and Chiellini was as cool as a pickle, cracking jokes. And Jordi Alaba, they had no idea what was going on there. To me, it's kind of like a PG-13 light version of what we saw Materazzi with Zidane kind of getting in his head. But for me, when I look at that routine, I thought more, this is maybe the one time where non-Juve fans were like, you know what? This Chiellini guy, not bad. Kind of same as Materazzi, who was despised by non-Inter fans for a long time. But then that game against France, it's like, well, he may be an asshole, but he's our asshole today. So what did you make of that routine? And, you know, you and I are familiar with how players are perceived in Italy. Maybe people that are a little bit out of it are surprised to find out that players like Buffon and Chiellini are not really that loved by non-Juve fans. So what did you make of that little routine? And do you think in that moment, at least non-Juve fans liked them more than usual?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a comparison with Materazzi. I mean, obviously, I think we also have to say that Jordi Alba is very antipatico, so anybody that's messing with him, I think, has a favorable view. I mean, I think it also showed the confidence in that scenario going into those penalty kicks. And I guess, as we saw in the actual shootout, that the confidence of the Italian players at that point versus, I think, Spain was definitely scared in that moment. I know they had the momentum going in there, and they obviously played a better game, but there was always that fear that they were going to go out to us again. And I think, you know, obviously, Chiellini, people call it mind games or whatever it was. I think that's also just his personality. I mean, off the pitch, he seems very, you know, he's very gentleman and playful, and he's not the warrior you see on the pitch all the time. So I don't know what you make of it. I mean, it was definitely something that could more Italy fans could get around, and definitely better that it wound up with us winning those penalties, because imagine if we didn't, and then everybody would just be circulating memes of Chiellini with Alba in a negative light. So definitely better we won.
Yeah, I certainly agree. And look, you know, for people that aren't that familiar with Chiellini off the pitch, you know, he is a pretty unique guy. I mean, there's not that many Serie A players who have a university degree. He has that and a master's degree, and he's been kind of with social media, he was way ahead of the game. I mean, for a while, he had more followers than Buffon when Buffon was much more popular. So I've always been a big fan of him as a person on top of a player. So let's talk briefly about the game. And I think in this sense, we can also kind of measure his worth. So Chiellini, I thought against Belgium, that was really, really a great performance. One-on-one against Lukaku. I thought against Spain without a frame of reference up front. If Luis Enrique was smart in that game, then Morata comes in, he scores. But the first half, I thought Spain played better. Now we're going to face Kane. So this should be up Chiellini's alley. But let me ask you this. How much more confident would you be on Italy's chances if I told you that Chiellini's definitely playing the whole game? And how much does your opinion on what could possibly happen if, say, Chiellini is not able to play the second half because he's had a lot of injuries recently?
Well, I mean, Chiellini obviously is, when he's healthy, he's Italy's best defender. You know, if he's not going to play or play only a half, I mean, that's a big detriment to the national team. I mean, your backups are Acerbi or Bastoni. Obviously, Acerbi's been a solid player. He's not Chiellini's level. Bastoni is up and coming and very impressive. But, I mean, he just brings also that aura of being that warrior and having that pedigree that, you know, certain players that go on the field and you fear. And I think he's one of those for opposing teams. I mean, it's like when Cristiano Ronaldo shows up and plays in a provincial city outside. I mean, people just are scared to go against him. So I think that's kind of the aura Chiellini has for Italy at the back at this time.
Fair. So now let's talk about Chiellini's partner back there, both at Juve and Italy, Bonucci, who, you know, because of the way he carries himself, his experience at Milan, maybe hated even more than Chiellini by non-Juve fans. But I have to say that while it is easy to point to some defensive lapses, and he's had issues, especially when not playing with Chiellini, I have to say, off the top of my head, I can't think of a defender that I watched in Serie A quite as good as he is at passing, playing out of the back, getting teams out of the opposing press. So what do you make about Bonucci's passing ability? And you're a calcio historian. Is there anyone that you see close to being in his league in that regard?
I mean, definitely of the players that I've seen play in my lifetime, which, you know, I obviously was born in 88, so I started watching when I was a little kid in the late 90s. I mean, Bonucci is probably the best passing defender I've seen of Italian defenders. I guess that stems also from his first, you know, foray into calcio as a youth. He was a central midfielder. And, you know, as often the story with a lot of players, they just tell people that, you know, if you're going to make it at a high level, you're going to have to move to this position. And Bonucci was unfortunately not a good central midfielder, but coach saw, I forgot where it was. I think it might have been an inter youth system. They told him that he would be a good central defender. So I think definitely, yes, in my lifetime, he's been the best passing, ball-playing Italian defender. I mean, I know people say Baresi. Obviously, I didn't ever, you know, Baresi's a little before my time. So the tail end of his career. So I think that would probably be the best prior to Bonucci passer in Italian defenders. Other than that, I think that's where we'd go.
Yeah, I totally agree. And look, Baresi was much better defensively than Bonucci. And, you know, he was good out of the back, but I don't think it's quite on the level of Bonucci. So now let's talk about an up-and-coming center back. And look, you know, it's somewhat a little bit similar to the impact Conte had on Bonucci at Juve. I thought it was great for Bastoni to have Conte at Inter. So what do you make of Bastoni as a player? And do you think maybe he can be the next Chiellini, kind of following those footsteps?
Well, with Bastoni, I think what we have to say is that he's gotten the best school, which is the Antonio Conte school. So he definitely had that in his favor and improving. And the improvements that he's made since being at Inter and being coached by Conte have been astronomical. I mean, I really think that he's probably, out of anyone, probably the next great Italian defender, and it shows. You know, he has the physique. He has some ball playing ability too. And he has great sense of anticipation. I think that's the next great Italian defender in terms of if you're looking as a whole. Because and honestly, I think Chiellini and Bonucci are kind of the last of the Mohicans. I mean, Italy has always been known for great defenders. And that's what we're talking about today. But the future doesn't really look bright, honestly.
Yeah, I kind of agree because I was going to, and you know, maybe there are other young up-and-coming defenders that you see kind of that could follow in Bastoni's league. But I have to say, when I look in Serie A, there are some intriguing, you know, foreign defenders that, you know, I think can be really good. But is there any other young Italian defender that stands out to you as someone that you think can eventually be an important player for the Nazionale?
No, that's the crazy thing. I really don't think there are. It's crazy. I mean, you know, I watched the under-21 tournament this summer, and if you look at Italy's squad, I mean, the defenders were not great at all, and they really struggled at the back. And it's sad to see because, I mean, it's just it's something we never lacked, but it looks like going forward, in addition to a world-class striker, we're always going to be missing world-class defenders, which is, you know, obviously there's always the surprises that come out of nowhere, like even Bonucci was. But it's just it's sad to see. I really don't think there's anything out there, honestly, at the moment.
Yeah, I completely agree with you there. So next thing before we get to our draft that I wanted to discuss is, you know, when I was growing up, it was always four at the back. There was a lot of man marking. Eventually with Sacchi, we had more zone defending. And then, you know, in this millennium, we had a shift to a lot of teams going with a three at the back. And, you know, there's a good amount of teams in Serie A that have that as their base formation. We've seen some teams in Europe actually do pretty well, even non-Italian teams there. So I want to ask you, when you look at kind of this transition to three at the back, do you think it's more Mazzarri, who at Napoli kind of started that, or do you think we really kind of needed Conte with the great BBC to establish it as one of the go-to defenses in Serie A?
Well, if you read interviews with Mazzarri, he always says he was the first one to do it and first one to make it known. And it's true. I mean, obviously in his whole career, and he started earlier than Conte, he always played a 3-5-2 or a variation of 3-4-3. I mean, that was actually probably, though, a direct result, I mean, of teams playing, if you remember in the 90s, teams would play three central defenders, but they would play with two wingbacks who were more defenders, like kind of like a 5-3-2. I mean, like, I guess an example, since we're on the national team topic, like if you look at like Dino Zoff's national team at Euro 2000, he had kind of Maldini, Maldini, Cannavaro, and Nesta, three center backs, and then he had Pesotto and Di Livio, like as wingers, yeah, which in this day and age would be outside midfielders or wingers, but back then it was just added defenders. So they just go to more defensive when they defended. So it was kind of like a 5-3-2, even on paper it was a 3-5-2. So I think it was just the evolution of that into something more proactive and positive. So, I mean, Mazzarri was really the one that kind of brought it on. Like Conte kind of adapted it because, as you remember, Conte loved the 4-2-4, kind of like
Yeah, Kuda. He did. He did.
So, yeah, but I think Mazzarri was really the one that made it known in Serie A in the early 2000s.
Yeah, so let's talk about look, and I think a lot of people kind of see Bonucci as, oh, he excels with three at the back because he can be more of the regista, but we also see that he can be really quite good when he's paired with Chiellini. I thought the game against Spain was maybe Bonucci's best game of the Euro. But are there some defenders that you think are specialists of three at the back that maybe you think of a little bit less because of it? Like for me, De Vrij comes to mind. I'm a huge fan of De Vrij. I think he's great. I think he's been one of the best center backs in Serie A in recent years. But then I wonder, you know, take him out of that formation, would he be quite as good?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard to say because, I mean, I don't know many, you know, youth systems that play with three at the back. You know, I think most defenders come up in a four system, and it's something they adapt to as professionals, and we get kind of stuck in that in that formation or that get that tag on them because they just played so long that they then, if you're working so long on a certain tactics and certain formation, then you get just thrown into something else that you're not used to, then it's when things get wrong. I mean, kind of like Bonucci when he left Juventus and went to Milan, when playing three at the back to four in the back, and it looked like he was lost, even though people say it was just because he needed somebody better next to him. But I think that's, you know, I don't know if necessarily it's players that are in certain formations that are better. I just think it's they adapt to certain things that they're not used to. I think any player can be taught to do anything, honestly, just with the proper training.